In the 2002 NBA draft, Roger Mason Jr. was the 31st pick. He's overcome challenges to become successful in every part of his life. Yet his time at UVA is somewhat forgotten. For T-Dubs in Cali and Dougie Fresh Smith across the Hudson in Jersey City, I'm Mark Jerome, and this is Locker Room Access. T-Dubs, what do you remember about Roger Mason Jr.?
I mean, that era was really the start of the Gillen era. So I think, you know, a lot of people tend to forget that era. They just don't. I don't know if they're not proud of it or there wasn't enough success. But Roger was, he was an incredible player. He got hurt towards the end, and he was like the first player to leave early, in my memory, like leave early to go to the draft. And I wonder if that really soured the relationship with the university in some kind of way. And we talk about that. It's so cool to hear him actually talk about how he wishes he had a bigger role. Like, his name never comes up. We've been doing these Mount Rushmores. I mean, we've never heard anyone talk about Roger Mason. And it's not like he was, you know, perennial All-American, but he was a hell of a player. And he's kind of just, I really don't get it. And it's so cool to hear his perspective on it all and how he feels about it. And like, this is a rare, he said, this is the first like real Virginia thing he's done since he left school. What do you remember, Doug?
Yeah, for me, it's the same. There's definitely a disconnect, and maybe it's because of that era of Virginia basketball. I remember going to see him play a couple times. Knew he was a great player, but for me, I think of him more as an NBA player than as a former University of Virginia player for whatever reason. And I think the podcast sheds a lot of light on how he really was able to overcome things and find himself in the right situations, right? Like, a lot of guys complain, I was never given the opportunity. He seemed to have developed that and make that happen for himself. Pat Riley, Popovich, you know, all these guys he crossed paths with, LeBron. It doesn't happen just by chance, right? It's for a reason. I think he's really good at that.
Talking about a guy who's had great careers in college, really good career in the NBA, and now very successful as a post-NBA player in real estate and other businesses and working with the NBPA. And his success, when I think about people at UVA, when you look at, when we're talking about when on the recruiting trips and you're looking at past players, as you mentioned, T-Dubs, he's never listed as a Mount Rushmore. And he's almost like, man, when I think about Corey and Ralph and Brian Stith and the recent guys, his name, I don't even think about his name sometimes. And he was a really, really good player. I mean, he had a great career. We talked about the one game in the NCAA tournament where he torched, who was that, Gonzaga, when they ended up losing?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he and that was his sophomore year?
That was sophomore year,
that was his second year?
Yeah. And he was incredible. Like, he was a great – it's kind of funny, like – In the weird Pete Gillen era where things didn't feel like Virginia, he was the most Virginia thing we had, right? He played the piano. He was all around good guy. He loved academics. He screams UVA, and yet here we are. Like, we've somehow forgotten about the guy. It's like completely strange. I think it is due to that era. Like, he talked about, like, the strain that he had after, you know, deciding he's going to leave early and everyone kind of being disappointed with him. But it was like, he talks about it. It's amazing, like, hearing his perspective, and I think that's the first time I've ever heard that, so it's pretty neat.
We are now joined by Roger Mason Jr. Roger, thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
So we do a podcast called The Jay Willie Show. We premiered it on YouTube on Monday night, and on the right column, people make comments. Ted Jeffries made the comment, DMV has the best basketball. Or what he said was, DMV has the best Catholic school basketball. I think that was the comment he made.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that, growing up in DMV?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about other places, but I know that in my era, the Catholic school league in D.C. was top. I mean, if you look at the top 20 teams in the country, we had three or four of them.
And I think what Ted was also saying was, because somebody wrote back, New York has a lot of great pros too, or has a lot of good basketball players too. And Ted said, name them. But when you look at the DMV, yourself, like the kids that have gone to even just Virginia.
Yeah. Right?
Justin, I don't know who, name a few, Ted Jeffries.
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of guys from Gonzaga, DeMathica, Council, Keith Bogans, Joe Forte. You know, there's a lot of guys in my era that not only the Catholic League, just the DMV overall. You know, when you start talking about DeMar Johnson and, you know, Steve Francis and
Grant Hill,
younger, Jeff Green, KD. You know, there's a lot of ballers from the DMV.
I was actually on a conversation, a text yesterday with several people, and one of them was my cousin talking about the players out of the Bay Area, right? He was talking about his guys, and he said he'll put him up against anybody. I don't know. DMV does have a lot of really, really good players.
Oh, those Dunbar teams, right? Back in the day?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
What was it particularly about the DMV area that prepared you for a career at UVA and in the NBA?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was young, we used to go to University of Maryland in the summertime. And whether it's a Boys and Girls Club or the summer runs, that's when everybody would come back home, all the pros, all the young up-and-comers. And I just think that competition, the competitiveness, the AAU circuit, of course, back then was bar none. I mean, we won the Nationals when I was starting at 11. We won 11 and 14 AAU Nationals. So we've always just kind of had that competitiveness and always had the handles and a crossover. So I think that had a lot to do with it.
How about the coaching? I'm always curious to know about coaching on the AAU level, because I'm not a proponent of New York City coaching. And I think New York City guys aren't always prepared when they go to college or when they go to the next level, because the coaching just isn't as good. And I remember being an AAU coach with younger guys, including with Ty and Donovan Mitchell and a bunch of other guys, Eric Pascal were on my team. And I was looking 2 years, I guess we were in a tournament and there was a team from the DMV area. And just their skill level and their fundamentals were so much better.
Yeah.
Kids in New York. I was like, that's got to be a result of coaching.
100%. I mean, my coaching was phenomenal growing up. I mean, the same program, the Silver Spring Blue Devils, KD came up after us, and they really focused on fundamentals. So for us, you know, we did a lot of individual workouts before it was cool to do that. You know, we were working on our games. We were fundamentally sound. We played team basketball, and it really translated, you know, with the type of programs that we went to in high school and college.
So how did you end up picking UVA?
So I grew up, obviously, in D.C. I grew up right in Maryland's backyard, and I just grew up watching the ACC. So I watched the old Virginia teams with Harold Dean, Curtis Staples. I watched, you know, North Carolina, Duke, NC State. You know, I grew up watching ACC basketball, so I knew I wanted to play in the ACC. At the same time, you know, initially I thought I wanted to go to Duke because I wanted to go to a really good academic school. And so Duke recruited me. Maryland recruited me late, so I kind of had a grudge on Maryland. I didn't like the fact that Gary Williams didn't aggressively pursue me, so I turned them down. And then it was Virginia, and really it came down to Virginia, Syracuse, NC State. But I wanted to be close to home, but away, and I really wanted to go to a great academic school. And I liked the fact that Virginia weren't good. Like, they were terrible. And I felt like we could have the recruiting class to kind of turn it around. So I liked that challenge of being kind of that first group to come in and change things up.
Was that Pete Gillen's pitch to you?
Pete Gillen's pitch, you know, it was less about his pitch. You know, I was comfortable with him. It was more so about the school. The school sold itself. The campus sold itself. Being in the ACC sold itself. And so, you know, for me, I looked on the roster. I thought I'd have an opportunity to make a big impact. My goal was to make it to the NBA. And I felt like that program, you know, and the opportunity there could help me do that.
Yeah.
How much did style of play at that time factor into your decision? I know you're talking about the other things, but, you know, Coach Gillen had that run and gun style that he promoted pretty heavily as you coming in. Was that even a factor for you, or?
Yeah, it wasn't as much of a factor. It should have been, but I was so young, man. For me, I felt like I could play in any system. And, you know, as a skilled player, you know, I just wanted an opportunity and I wanted a stage and platform. And I felt like the ACC did that, being close to home did that. And I thought the college, the academic aspect of it was great. So I didn't really pay a whole lot of attention, but obviously it was attractive that he wanted to score a lot and get up and down.
You must have been in the first or second group that was all Pete Gillen, right? The rest of the guys were the era before with Jeff Jones?
Yeah, I think I was his first recruiting class. We were top two recruiting class in the country.
Yeah, so your mindset was he's trying to put the stamp on the program with his, you guys are his guys, right?
Like yeah,
Michael, well, Jeff Jones came after Coach Holland, so I get
exactly,
it.
Exactly. We had a lot of walk-ons that played the year before. We knew we had a chance to have a top two or three recruiting class with McDonald All-Americans and top 25 players. So we kind of felt like we were the young guns to come in and turn it around.
And you'd rather do that? Were you always kind of the alpha that, like, I want to go into that situation where I got it's on my back, as opposed to blend in with the Duke guys and get an Escalade?
Yeah. Yeah, like, I enjoyed the challenge. There's definitely some schools that were more attractive for my pockets. You know what I mean? But, you know, that wasn't Virginia.
Do you care to elaborate at all?
I'm not going to elaborate. There's enough people that have. But I'll say.
I know Syracuse is really cold in the winter. It takes a lot to get you to go up there. 5 feet of snow in March. And I love Syracuse. I love all of them, but we get it.
So you played 21 minutes a game as a freshman. That's remarkable, right? You score 7.5 points a game. What were you thinking your freshman year?
Going to freshman. Like, I was pissed. I was upset. I felt like I deserved more minutes. I felt like, you know, I was working hard in practice and I should have played more. And I remember right before the ACC tournament, I was thinking, man, I want to leave. I was unhappy. But I stuck through. I had a great summer working out. Like, that transition from my freshman year to my sophomore year, I worked my ass off. And I came back a better player. I just looked in the mirror. But that was a tough first transition for me because I expected better things than that.
Yeah, the first year is hard. Like, no matter how good the DMV is, how fundamentally you sound, there's always a jump, right? And you know the jump because, A, you did it in college in the ACC, B, you did in the NBA. But a lot of guys, it's hard to get that. So I was talking to your former teammate, Willie Dersh, and he remembered it as you kind of didn't struggle, but trying to fit in, always working hard. And then he said you had a huge game against Duke at the end of your first year. And I think, and Willie said to me as a senior, he's like, I got it. Roger, this is your position. You earned it. And he felt like that's when you really, you know.
Yeah, I got to give it to Willie too, because I remember, you know, highly tutored, McDonald's All-American, he was starting. And I remember after that game, he was always kind of like, he saw a lot in me, Willie did, you know? And I got some vivid memories of kind of following in his footsteps my freshman year, but he was always good to me and was a good vet.
What was your relationship with Gillen like?
Yeah, you know, my relationship while I was playing there was great, you know.
How about your freshman year, I mean, like during the freshman year, was that tough?
Freshman year, you know, like anybody, I wanted to play
your
more.
Your first year, excuse me.
Yeah, my first year. I wanted to play more. And, you know, I was unhappy with my minutes, but at the same time, you know, he was encouraging. The assistant coaches were great. And then obviously I made a big leap my sophomore and junior years. And so my relationship with Pete was great. You know, unfortunately, Majestic Map got hurt. I was able to play point guard, and that really helped me with my pro positioning. Our relationship kind of took a turn for the worse when I decided to enter my name in the draft. Because obviously he wanted me to come back. He was under a lot of heat for trying to have a winning program. And I think that's when we kind of lost touch.
But I mean, I'll take a step back. Before that, you're coming into your second year. Was the onus on – was it really on you to improve? Like you said, you looked in the mirror, figured out the parts of your game. Was there a coach that sat you down and showed you some things, or was it 100% on you?
I'll say Tommy Herrien was a guy that recruited me, and we spent a lot of time, you know, in the gym on film, looking at ways to improve. I was a gym rat, and there wasn't going to be anybody that outworked me. So that summer, you know, I played a lot with Steve Francis back in D.C. Mm-hmm. I played with a lot of the pros, and that was the summer that I said I need to make this big leap, and that's what I did.
And you think that's something, you know, players today, because, like, the transfer, obviously the transfer portal is like growing and growing every year, with kids kind of playing the blame game instead of looking in the mirror and saying, "Oh no, I'm going to tough this out." Do you think that's the transfer portal thing is feeding into that?
I think it is feeding into that, because when I looked at having to sit out, that wasn't going to be an option for me with transferring. And a lot of times, man, it is better to look within. I mean, clearly there's some times where, you know, a change of scenery is probably a better opportunity. But I think that you're right. That portal probably encourages it a little bit more than how it was back in our day.
And I was going to ask, I mean, we're doing a photo series later, but I'll get into more details. But talk about your you know, second year when you were coming up and the expectations coming into that second year. Because, like, you know, I had just left school, but I was following it. Obviously, it's my religion for me. But I remember the expectations, like, you guys are coming back, here we go. Like, what do you remember from that time?
Yeah, I mean, the expectations were a lot higher, you know, a year older, another solid recruiting class. And, you know, remember that Chris Williams, Adam Hall year, Chris was rookie of the year, so now he was a year older, and with the new guys, you know, there were some preseason expectations, and we met a lot of them. You know, we had a really solid year. I'll never forget freaking losing to Gonzaga at the buzzer. That's like one of my nightmares. But overall, coming into that year, it was a lot of expectation for sure.
And I mean, just to dive right into the style back then, I just remember as a fan, the Pete Gillen timeouts were infamous, right? He'd go, the other team would go on a run, timeout, we'd have no timeouts left, and there's 15 minutes left in the game, and fans are absolutely going crazy. But you guys won a lot of close games. Talk about, like, how that strategy was. I imagine the onus was on you a lot, and I'm sure that helped you in a lot of instances, but do you remember that being the case? Like, we got no timeouts, I got to make this shit happen.
I remember it. I do. And I was just so locked in to, like, dealing with whatever hand we were dealt. But, I mean, there were times where it's 12, 13, 15 minutes left in the game and timeouts are out. So it's like, all right, we're going to have to do this on the court. You know, bottom line, like, we can't expect anything else. So that was just the mentality. It was to take whatever, you know, whatever was there.
And what'd you guys talk about in the timeouts? I don't think you were drawing up many plays.
You know, it was funny. You know, you're bringing me back down memory lane. I haven't, like, gone back into my memory on this, but now there were times where it was a whole lot of kind of nothing, you know, going on in the huddle. And
I'll give you my fresh story. Myself and Willie Dersch, who had graduated, his first job was working with me on the American Stock Exchange. And we drove down, I think you guys were fifth in the country, and you have NC State, who has not won at Virginia since 1989, coming in town. The place was going crazy. You guys were the shit, everything else. And the game goes on. Long story short, you guys were behind the whole game, came back. And right when it was time that y'all needed a bucket, I didn't feel like it was because of the players. There was just no concerted effort, like, you know, let's run Chicago or number one or whatever. So after the game, Roger, me and you guys ended up losing a tight game. And me and Willie go, and we're hanging out with Coach Harrion and Pete Gillen at Bryant Hall. And we, you know, we hung out a little bit before we went there and everything, had a couple Coors Lights. And so I'm like, "Coach Gillen, I asked you a question." He goes, "Yeah, Doug, sure, what do you got?" You know, and he's all upbeat and funny, the whole thing. I say, "Coach, do y'all have any plays on your team?" And he, like, makes a joke. Willie kicks me. He kicks the shit out of me under the table. He's like, "Fresh, shut up." I'm like, "No, I'm not kidding. Like, do you guys, like, say, like, let's do number one, get the ball to Roger Mason, get the ball to the post or whatever?" And he just – and Willie never lets me live that one down.
I got to give Coach Gillen a lot of credit, though. You know, he put the ball in my hands. He trusted and believed in me early on. And results, I had an 11-year career in the NBA, and that doesn't happen without his belief in me. So, you know, with that said, you know, Pete, let me run. Let me shine.
And I think one thing people probably don't remember, you can look it up, but the free throw percentage for Roger, those those years incredible, right? It's like one or two, three every single year. So like, I don't remember losing a lot of close games. I know people griped about, oh, we don't have timeouts, but I was kind of like, show me a game where really it hurt us, like not having a timeout. And there weren't many instances of that. Just maybe the fact that when they went on the run, we'd just get crushed or we'd win a close game, right? I feel like that was generally the consensus. And we didn't do well on the road. Maybe you could talk about that too. Like, what were the road games like for you guys back in those days?
Yeah, I mean, I remember we had really zero success at Cameron, and that was disappointing. I always loved those games. You know, I can't really put a finger on it. You know, I have no idea why. You know, I think typically in league, role players typically play better at home, and so we didn't have a whole lot of help on the road. I can't even identify why.
Yeah, because I remember, I mean, that kind of haunted the Gillen and some of the Leto era. It was always like solid at home, could not get it done on the road. And then in the ACC tournament, it was like, we played NC State every year, so they were tough.
The ACC was like that back then, though, man. Like, Crotty hit on it. Crotty never won in Cameron, right? But we beat Duke at home all the time.
Yep.
We actually got one win in Cameron in my 4 years. But, you know, you go to Clemson, we're talking about it. You go into Maryland,
Coalfield House, ooh, that was tough. And what was that like for your homecoming game going back to Maryland?
That was always fun. We beat Maryland at Coalfield. It was always a great time coming home, and I wanted to kick those guys' ass. I couldn't stand Maryland.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Ron Dixon, Blake.
And then later, Kaner Medley. Those guys, I couldn't stand them. They were just so annoying. Yeah. So those were some good games, though.
Do you remember your final game during your third year at UVA?
I do, man. My final game was bittersweet, because we had a disappointing my junior year, third year. It was a disappointing year. We were highly touted. We were supposed to make the tournament, and it was a flop. And I remember when we didn't make the NCAA tournament, what's that other tournament that they have?
NIT.
NIT. Yeah, I got that out of my memory bank. But that was
be careful. You're talking to an NIT champ right over here.
Good for you.
I get made fun of for that a lot too. But
yeah, no, that it was probably one of the worst games of my career, because I let the emotions of a terrible year and not making the tournament. It wasn't a great experience.
Yeah, it's tough.
So was that weighing on you at the next level, thinking about the next level? And when did you decide you were going to go to the next level? Was it midway through the season? Was it the beginning of the season?
My sophomore year, I toyed with the idea of leaving for the NBA, and we decided against it. I met with Pete, and I played for the USA team. I tried out for the USA team, made it, and played in China. But we had done some interviews with agents before the season, so I had a pretty strong clue that I was going to leave after my junior year if things went well. And personally, I played fine, but our team just didn't do, you know, I wanted to try to win in the tournament. And so we didn't do well, and I got hurt. And I dislocated my shoulder against, I think it might have been NC State, actually. And it was the first time I had a significant injury. And, that really, for me, made my decision a lot easier, because I was going to have to redshirt. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know that if I came back to college, I would have missed my senior year, and I would have had to do a redshirt year because of the surgery. So I prefer to be doing rehab as a pro than in college and waiting another year.
Well, the decision to leave early, we were talking about this earlier. You were really the first UVA guy to really do it in that fashion. Because, right, Ralph stayed, Stith stayed, Crotty stayed, you know, Harold D, Jamal, they all did their 4 years. And so was there a feeling of pressure of staying? Like, oh, I got to see this all the way through? Or because
100%. 100%. I felt a lot of pressure. You know, I was an academic, you know, honor roll student. I wanted to live on the lawn. I wanted to get my jersey retired. So they're giving me all of that, you know, Pete and everybody, you know, working in the athletic department is like, come back, live on the lawn, get your number retired, go to the Final Four. So I wanted all those things. At the same time, my lifelong dream was making it to the NBA. There hadn't been any other guy to leave early. So I remember Corey Alexander calling me nonstop, telling me I shouldn't go. You're not going to be a first round pick. It was like Pete Gillen was getting everybody to call me. So it was a very tough decision for myself.
You know why Corey was calling you though, right?
Why was Corey calling me?
He's mad he didn't leave early, so. He didn't want you to be the first one. That's all, Roger. It wasn't nothing personal, yo.
I could tell you from a fan's perspective, it was exciting because, you know, I'm probably one of the rare ones that I love the NBA, and I always want to see Virginia guys make it in the NBA because I feel like long-term that's better for the brand. But I know it's hard to think long-term versus short, but it was exciting to us because it's like you're leaving early and you're going to the league, and that's like ultimately the dream, and to see a player that you love and follow and do his career. I think, you know, you guys probably don't get that perspective when you're going through this thinking, oh, everybody's going to hate me when I'm leaving. But there are definitely a chunk of fans that are excited when Justin and Ty and these guys leave because it's like, oh, my God, they're going to be in the league representing us. And that's amazing. But yeah, that's all. For us, just wanted to make sure you knew that there wasn't always everyone like, hey, trying to get you to stay. There was actually a group of people that wanted to see you go and succeed and do the thing.
That means a lot, actually. You know what I mean? Because I left early and I was like the first person to really do that, you know, I didn't really have the same love. I'm still not in the Hall of Fame. I still, you know, I didn't get the love that I would have probably got if I stayed 4 years.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, because there are definitely a group of fans that have followed you. I mean, look, I got all your jerseys. I mean, it's like, you know, there's a bunch of fans from that era that love and adore you. So I think when this comes out, you'll see hopefully that the admiration coming out.
That's what's up, man.
So you talked about all those things. You wanted to have your jersey retired, Hall of Fame. You mentioned you wanted to live on the lawn. So it sounds like your Charlottesville, your Virginia experience outside of basketball was great too, right?
Oh,
your students, you obviously.
It was a great experience. You know, I loved UVA. I loved everything about it. It was a great, great experience for me, for sure. Even outside the court.
So when someone says to you, "Hey, I'm getting recruited by UVA," tell me about UVA. Describe UVA outside of basketball. What's your pitch to them?
Yeah, I mean, one, it's a great academic school, great network of alumni and people. The school itself is a lot of fun. The campus is gorgeous. You know, I've been carrying the UVA flag since I went there, you know, so helping out whatever coach, you know, is coaching the team with players and talking to these guys in the locker room. I remember talking to Ty and Dre and all those young guys before, you know, anybody knew if they were going to be good or not. But, you know, I loved everything about UVA. And so I've always been really positive in that regard.
Yeah, and I know that coaching staff spoke highly of you because – I got a message or a call from Ron Sanchez one day after you had visited and was really grateful that you came and spoke to the kids, student athlete, the basketball team, right, about things that you're doing and about the next level and off the court opportunities. So I know that that connection's real.
No, for sure.
So and you I, hurt your sh- – go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You hurt your shoulder, right? And you said if you came back, you'd have the red shirt. Was your agent at that time, whoever you picked, was he saying – let's get this done. Don't worry. You're going to still be a first draft pick. Or if you're a second round pick, you'll be early.
Yeah. So for me, when I first declared, it was, you know, top 15 pick was where my range was. And I had hurt my shoulder against NC State. I took off for like a week. I didn't miss any games. I came back probably a little bit early before strengthening it. And in my first workout against the Detroit Pistons, I dislocated it twice again. So the first time I did it, I had torn my labrum. And my first workout, I did it again. And they were like, look, you're not going to be able to work out anymore during the draft. So, and you may need surgery. So if you go back to college, you're going to miss your senior year. You're going to have to redshirt, stay in the draft, and you still have a very good chance of being drafted in the first round. If not, you'll be an early second round pick. So I stayed, you know, with it.
And when the names were being called throughout the first round and they get to 12 and 15 and 18, what are you thinking at that time?
So I knew that Indiana at 14, they told me they were going to draft me. So Isaiah Thomas basically told me, you know, we're going to draft you if you're there. They drafted Fred Jones. So after them, then we knew 20, and then 27 was the Lakers. So I knew I had a very good shot at going to the Lakers. They traded Kareem Rush. So now I'm at 27, 28. And this happened to be the year that the Minnesota Timberwolves forfeited their first round pick because they did an under the table deal with Joe Smith. So they don't have a first pick. So there's less first round picks this year. So I ended up going, and then the Golden State Warriors had the 30th pick, but they had Gilbert Arenas. So my agent told them that I was afraid of Bridges and that I would not go to San Francisco so they wouldn't draft me. So I didn't visit with them. So luckily they drafted Steve Logan and I was the 31st pick to the Bulls. And when I heard my name, man, I was so upset. Like I was literally crying. You know what I mean? I'll never forget. The draft was not a happy day for me because I loved college. So I would have had no problem going back had I not got hurt. And then I wanted to be a first round pick so bad, you know, being the 31st pick, I wasn't so happy about it, but ended up working out in the end.
I mean, where were you watching the draft? Like what were your draft night plans?
So I had a draft party with my family, just all my family in an apartment in DC, like in a little ballroom in DC. And I was relieved when I heard my name, but it definitely put a big chip on my shoulder that I was the 31st pick. Really the 30th selection, but the 31st pick.
The teams that passed you up, that passed up on you, that promised they were going to take you?
I outlasted 95% of my class. You know, I was in the 10th year of my career. Everybody that was drafted behind, but in front of me, they were out of the league. So, you know, I got my revenge. I had Indiana circle every time I played them. I think myself and Michael Jordan are the only ones on the Wizards to score over 31 points off the bench. And so that was against Indiana. So, yeah, I used it as motivation for sure.
And what about the guys that all got picked ahead of you? You have them on a list. You always hear people have a list, and every time you go up, you just bust their ass because they were picked before you. Did you do that? Yeah.
No, I mean, I did. I paid attention. I paid attention to everything. I used it as motivation, you know, and I think, you know, most players tend to do that. But, you know, I had a hard journey, man. My first 3 years in the league, and then I was out of the league for a year. And I had to fight back in. So it wasn't always like an easy thing for me.
Why were you out of the league after your first 2 years, first 3 years?
So I got drafted by Jerry Krause, by the Bulls. And the next year, obviously, I missed my first 66 games. So I'm coming off an injury coming to the NBA. Jerry loved me. I was his guy. And the next year, they fired Krause. The Bulls did. So now they brought in Paxson. So Paxson wanted to bring in all his own – his guys. He didn't want a Krause guy around, so they traded me to Toronto. My first year in Toronto, I did great. My third year in the league, they told me I had a heart disease and that I'd never play basketball again. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. I'm writing a book actually right now and talking a lot about that. But
where did that come from? A physical? A random physical or something?
It was right after my physical. They said I had a heart disease and that I'd never be able to play basketball again. And I like passed out. It was like, what are you talking about? And the first half of the season, I was on the team, but they wouldn't let me play. And in December, they waived me. And I had gone through Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic. My agent had me going around the world. And everybody said, this is ridiculous. It's not true. But they waived me anyway. And so I had to go to Europe for a year and reestablish myself.
Did you put that doctor on that specific list of people's asses you're going to bust during games?
I put Toronto Raptors on that list. You're damn right.
socialized medicine in Canada. That's what you get. I never knew that. That's crazy.
I had no idea. That's amazing.
Did you have a mentor coming up? You seem like you're a guy that like soaks information off of people, like talking about the pros in Maryland.
Yeah, I was so fortunate. I had a lot of people that helped me along the way. Mentors, both as players and then mentors as businessmen. So I lost my dad at an early age, at 10. So there have been a lot of mentors in my life that have kind of helped me, give me the knowledge to what to look out for and things of that nature.
So you go to Greece, is that right?
So I get waived in December, and in January I signed with Olympiakos in Greece, the Euro League. I play there for 5 months. They paid me a lot of money. And then the next year, it's like, you know, I've been cleared medically, but it's like, you know, this team in Israel wants 4 NBA players, and they'll pay you a lot of money. You know, I'm like, all right, I'm young. I want to get the ball back in my hands where I'm the man again. If I go to a team in the NBA, I'm not going to play a lot. I'm going to go to Israel for a year, and I'm going to get my game back, and I'm going to come back to the NBA, and that's kind of my approach. So I took the money. We went to Jerusalem, and I had a life-changing experience there, treated it like it was a basketball camp just to get better. And then the following year, I made it back to the league.
When you say you had a life-changing experience, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, just being in the holy city of Jerusalem, where all three major religions are. This is before high-speed internet. This is 2005, 2006. And so, you know, I stopped watching TV because there was nothing to watch. You know, I really dedicated my game to my workouts, 2-a-days, 3-a-days. Spiritually, it was great. You know, I had my Shabbat dinners with my Jewish families, and I just got to experience something totally different. And it really kind of helped mold me. It made me a little bit more worldly. And by the time I got back to the NBA, I was very sharp and very focused on what I wanted to do with my career.
I mean, players, you know, we've heard from a bunch of guys now, BJ, Isaiah, who've had horrible experiences overseas. And then we've heard from a bunch that have had amazing experiences, like, you know, AG loves it, doesn't want to come back. So, you know, talk about like how you decided that. What was the vetting process like for you when you were deciding, do I go? Was it, did you call other players that have been on the team and make sure they got paid and all that?
Yeah, because I was coming from the NBA, and I was a young player, I had really great options, and so Olympiakos was a known, you know, yes, powerhouse in the EuroLeague, and they paid me a lot of money just for 5 months. And then in Israel, you know, they wanted 4 NBA players, so you know, the coach was like, "Look, we're going to run this like an NBA program. You could use this as a way to get back to the league." So I was very picky with my situations, and you know, that they paid me a lot of money, and so I knew that they were going to take it, you know, very serious.
All right, Roger, we've heard a lot of money a few times. Let's get the numbers. 5 months, how much? $2 million?
No, not that much. Back then, five months, I made like $400,000 without pre-tax.
Don't say that.
In Greece, they pay your taxes for you, and you can't be double taxed.
Right. Yeah, I get it. So, do you know Andrew Kennedy? Andrew played before me in Virginia.
I know Andrew very well.
Okay, so you made me think of him because he had a great experience. He made his living overseas, specifically in Israel.
Yeah,
and I think he was always a guy that we, you know, he was a mentor type. So,
he's a smart guy.
Yeah, and exactly. At that point, you know, you've had this experience. Was the site always get back to the NBA, or was there a moment where you're like, you know what, I could actually just continue this overseas thing?
I was obsessive about getting back to the NBA.
Okay.
Like, this was like everything was mapped out. I'm going here, I'm going to take this money, and I'm getting back to the NBA. That was like, there was nothing getting in my way of that.
And then talk about Wizard. I always say talk about it. I hate when I say that. But the Wizards, you come home back literally home. I remember being so excited. I'm like, oh, now I can, you know, watch him right there at home. So what was it like for you getting that call from a hometown team?
So I actually didn't get the call.
Oh,
so
really?
I was back home, and like they said, you know, they're running over at the Verizon Center. Like, they're playing, they're hooping.
Okay.
So I just showed up, and so they were like playing pickup. So I started just playing pickup with people from DC, and then part of the guys in the team. And then Tim Connolly had known me from my days at the WCAC Catholic basketball. And you know, I was like, look, you know, could I play summer league? I approached them about it, and they were like, yeah. So I played on the summer league team. I was killing them in training camp. And then right before the summer league, I strained my hamstring. So I wasn't able to really play. But they loved what they saw. So they said, look, you know, you can come to camp. Now, my thing was I had a 7-figure deal to play in Spain because I had a good year in Israel. And so I told the Wizards and I told my agent, I'm not going to training camp without some kind of guarantee. Like they got to give me something. And they gave me $48,000 guaranteed. That was enough for me to say, all right, I'm going to go make this team.
Wow.
But you got to pay taxes too.
Exactly.
That's really about $37,000.
Yeah. But I bet on myself. I bet on myself. Absolutely. I said, you know, I'll turn down the 7 figures. I just need them to give me some type of commitment. And I went and I beat out, you know, the other guys and I made the team.
So what was your living situation? Were you literally just back home?
I was back home. So I had started investing in real estate. Okay. So because I had made some good money in Israel and Greece. So I had bought a couple properties in Maryland. So it was very easy for me to just live there.
Oh, that's amazing. And then the connection from there, I mean, did you feel like you were settled into the league at that point?
No. You know, my first year back, Gilbert Arenas, it was the Gilbert show and Karan and Antoine. And I was still just establishing myself. I was happy to be back in the NBA. First year, I had a run of 7 games. When Gil was hurt, when I really showed that I belonged. And then after that first year, the Spurs called and I went down there and worked out and they offered me a horrible contract, a 3-year unguaranteed minimum contract. And once again, I was like, I'm not taking that. And I got the Wizards offered me a 1-year deal to come back. And that next year I took that 1-year deal and that's when Gilbert got hurt and I got a real opportunity.
Wow, so you really had betting on yourself every year then at that point, right? It's just all about 1 year at a time. Don't get hurt. Were there nerves around, like, I can't get hurt, I got to keep my body in a particular shape, or were you just like, I'm hooping, it doesn't matter?
Yeah, I'm hooping. I was young. I wasn't thinking about any of that. I just wanted to hoop.
That's amazing.
Did you pay all your bets to Gilbert on time back then or no?
Well, you're assuming that I lost my bets. I'll tell you a funny story with Gilbert. So we were at this point, I've established myself and I'm known as like a shooter. And Antoine Jamison, they were playing cards. He's like, man, Roger Mason's the best shooter on our team. And Gilbert took offense to that. We're on the plane. He's like, no, he's not. He's not even close. And Jamison's just like egging Gilbert on, like, nah, he's a better shooter than you, Gil. And so Gilbert says, I'll bet you your contract. When we land in Minnesota, we'll go to the gym, we'll have a shooting contest. I'll bet your contract that I can beat you in the shooting game. And I'm like, bet, let's do it. So we land in Minnesota, and I was making probably 880 at the time. I was the league minimum. And I landed, and I called my agent, and I was like, I'm about to do a shooting contest with Gilbert Arenas. He wants to play me for my contract. And my agent is like, you cannot do that. You cannot do it. And I'm like, no, nah, man, I know I can beat him. He's like, you cannot do it. And I was like, nah, man, I'm still doing it. So I got off the phone with my agent. Everybody on the team is like hyping it up. So we land, put our bags down. The hotel had a court in it. We go to the gym. To
was
do
there
it.
A metal detector? Would you go through a metal detector first or no?
This is pre the gun situation. Okay.
This part of the story is mine, not yours. You stay. You do.
So anyway, we get to the gym. Gilbert's there talking trash. He's been in there. He's got a sweat. He's like, come on, man, let's do it. And Antoine Jamison. I was like, look, Twan, only way I'm doing this is if you put up for me. You put up for me. And Jamison was like, I can't do it, man. Don't do it. And I ended up saying to Gilbert, I couldn't do it. I had way too much to lose. For Gilbert, that was a drop in the bucket. Right. For me, that could have ruined my life. So I ended up not doing it. But it was that's funny awesome. Nonetheless.
Did you do the contest for fun then? Just for whatever?
No, we didn't end up doing it.
Let it go.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember watching a video where you hit, I think you did a college 3-1 and you hit whatever, 45 in a row or something crazy. Was that the same, around the same time?
Yeah, that was around the same time for sure. I when I was with the Raptors, I hit 245 free throws in a row, and then I ended up leading the Spurs. I made 97 out of 100 for the Spurs. I was always good in those workouts.
And then I got to ask about the 3-point contest when you were in it. What was that? You repped the UVA. I was so just the fact that you were there. What was that like?
That was a dream come true. That was like, I was a kid watching the 3-point contest, like aspiring. I didn't aspire to be an all-star. I wanted to make the 3-point contest. So that was really the pinnacle of my career. It's one of the best highlights to be recognized as one of the best shooters in the NBA. So it was great. When the shooting contest was about to happen, the 3-point contest, Spike Lee comes up to me. He's like, "Hey, man, I got all my money on you." I'm like, "Great. Thanks, Spike."
No pressure.
Again.
And then what was your prep like? Because Joe, you know, we talked to Joe about it, and he said he went, when he won it, he went to see Ron Sanchez. He shot in their local gym. He set it up exactly how he wanted it, and then he just went in and did it. Like, what was your prep time like?
Not to make excuses, but I was practicing for the 3-point contest, and they told me that the ball boy would be rolling the balls to you. So when I practiced with the ball just right in front of me, shooting it, you know, because they're pushing the balls to you. Well, when it came time to do it, they're like, "Oh, no ball boy is doing that. You have to reach back and get the balls." And that totally screwed me because I had been practicing a certain way. And then right when the contest happened, it was different. And I didn't perform the way I wanted to.
I hope Gilbert Arenas wasn't the guy that told you the misinformation there.
It might have been him.
Who won that year then? Who won the contest when you were in?
Daquan Cook won that year. It was Mike Bibby, Rashard Lewis, Paul, Danny Granger, but Daquan Cook won. Jason Capono was in it that year too.
Jason Capono from Syracuse.
UCLA, right?
UCLA.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, you were on, I remember you were on the Spurs that year. Was that the Christmas Day game where you hit the, yes.
Yeah, that was a Christmas Day. That was actually the year I led the NBA in game winning shots that year. So I had 5 game winners that year.
That's amazing. That was the year.
5 for 5, or did you have one when you had the last shot and didn't?
5 for 5.
Wow.
5 for 5.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
Get you the ball more, man.
Mark, do we want to jump into the?
Well, hold on a second. Two more questions about the NBA. You played for another 8 years when you came back from Europe, right?
Yeah.
Multiple teams: New York, Washington, San Antonio, New Orleans, Miami. What was your favorite team to play with?
My favorite team to play with by far was the Spurs with Coach Pop. I mean, I became a starter. I started with the Spurs. I had great success there. He's just an unbelievable coach, unbelievable program. And then I think that'd be 1A, and 1B would be Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra and the Miami Heat. The Heatles, actually. LeBron, Wade, Bosh, Ray Allen, who's a guy I looked up to, Rashard Lewis, Birdman. That team was a team of vets. We had a hell of a time. That was kind of the pinnacle. That's kind of when I was like, all right, man, I'm going to hang him up and go do something else. It was a great, great experience.
What separates Pop and Riley from the other coaches?
Well, I think accountability. I think those guys also have accountability even with their ownership. I think they're not, you know, they're all in lockstep. So I think that says a lot for them. I think, you know, whether it's the 15th guy on the roster or the top guy, they hold everybody accountable. And I think, you know, you can't have a winning organization that doesn't do that. I played for a lot of coaches. I played for a lot of programs. But those are the two kind of consistent characteristics that I would say are with those organizations.
And last question, and before we go to the Photo React series, what's the difference in cultures when they set that standard of accountability? So the difference between the Miami and the Knicks or San Antonio and the Knicks, when a player is maybe not doing what he's supposed to be doing or not as responsible, are they really saying, dude, you get it together or we're shipping you out?
Yeah, they do a really good job of factoring in character with the type of players that they sign. So it's not like they have a cast of characters that don't already kind of fit the Spurs way or the Miami Heat way. There's a Miami Heat type of player, right? When I played with the Knicks, it was a disaster because, you know, the locker room, the trade with Melo, I was on that team when Melo came and half the team left and it was just the culture was bad. And so you kind of see that, you know, in the different types of organizations.
T-Dubs, let's take it away to the Photo React series.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds awfully familiar in terms of style to Coach Bennett. All right, let's jump into and for those listening, we'll put this on YouTube, but we'll try our best. I know I don't do a great job describing the first photo. Is Adam Hall flying in the Reebok Answer 4s, which, by the way, I love that. That was so cool in terms of not being sponsored by Reebok. That was terrible. But the Answer 4s, that was a cool moment. But I wanted you to talk about Adam Hall for a minute. He goes to, he's kind of an underrated guy in terms of UVA history, but in terms of, like, the highlights that he brought and the, you know, he had some big shots over his course of his career. What do you remember about him?
Yeah, I gotta say, I got a lot of disappointment with Adam Hall. He was by far the most talented guy in the program. I mean, his athleticism, his strength, he should have been an NBA player. I think, you know, especially our junior year, Adam sat out a lot of that year with an injury, and I never questioned anybody's injury. You don't know other people's bodies, but you know, I just wish that we could have had a healthier Adam Hall while I played there because the guy was phenomenal talent. And, you know, one of those things, like, man, I wish I could have brought out more of him myself as well.
And the next one. So we had Scott Radcliffe on. This is a picture of Keith Jennifer and Pete Gillen. And let's just say Jerry had some interesting stories about Keith. What do you remember about him and maybe his relationship with Pete?
Yeah, Keithy was talented, man. A quick guard, yeah, stubborn, very stubborn, and in his kind of ways. And so, you know, that didn't really work out too well for him with Pete, but. But it was an interesting time, I'll say that.
by the way, TW calls Keith Jennifer Keith Enifer because he had no J.
Hey, well, that it was more his first year. I think he shot like 13. I think he shot 13% from three that year, and it just a lot of people started saying that. I definitely didn't come up with it. I don't have that level of creativity for that. But it was like. That was what everyone called him. It was terrible, but it was also like then he left, and he's kind of been the butt of a lot of UVA jokes over the years. But just always wanted to hear your take on him because I imagine none of that is true. But it's always fun to hear. Next one. This game, now this is a picture of Dan DeKal going up, you know, making a drive. But we talked about this prior. That game you had. I want to say you had 30. That was probably the most impressive game you had in your career in the tournament. And JC Mathis goes to the line. We're up three. He misses the front end of that 1-1. And then Dan DeKal comes down. Like, what do you remember about this? And you said it earlier. It kind of haunts you. But what do you specifically remember about the end of that game scenario?
I don't remember crying that hard since my dad died. Literally. Like, I was devastated because, you know, you're up three, you know, you're going for a 1-1. You think that you got the game. And it was devastating, man. That was one of the worst losses I've ever had on any level.
Yes. Virginia history, it's a program altering, right? I mean, I was telling these guys before, Pete Gillen did a Q&A, I think when he went to CBS. And he was just like, ask me anything. And I didn't give him any context. I just said, what happens if JC Mathis hits the front end of that 1-1? And he was just like, my life is completely different, I think. from one shot like alters the history of everything. And that leads that kind of leads to this slide right here, because we were talking like, what was that like? You had Indiana State, and this is the bracket, and this is our regional bracket. You had Indiana State as a 13 seed who upset Oklahoma right before, and then underneath you had Temple making it. So it was like, yeah, this is, just looking at this makes me upset, because it's like one shot and maybe we're in the Final Four, right? Is that how you looked at it too back in the day?
It's absolutely how I looked at it. And by the way, I was so confident. My mom wanted to go to the game, and I'm like, no, mom, don't come to the first round. Just come to the second round. So my mom didn't come because I convinced her not to, and she still gets on me about that to this day.
And that was – yeah, I mean, I think about that game way more than I should, even however many years it's been. But it like creeps into your mind, especially like Gonzaga's run started with against us, right?
And
like,
well, first of all, they shouldn't have been a 12 seed.
They should not. They were favored. They were favored. Let's keep it real.
There's no way they should have been a 12 seed. They screwed us.
Yeah, totally. But that was like the beginning of this, you know, like. We always talk about that's like the axis in terms of like Virginia's decline along with Gonzaga's uprisal into college.
100%. I mean, right? That momentum is the reason why we had such a disappointing year the following year.
Yep.
It was terrible.
It's crazy. That's crazy to think about. This change it up a little bit. You know, Willie, what do you remember about Willie? You talked about it a little bit. He was on our podcast, and he was so great in terms of like talking about, you know, he gave you a lot of props in terms of one of the guys he thought so highly of. What do you remember about his game?
Yeah, I mean, I remember, first of all, I heard of Willie because he was a McDonald's All-American, and he was a lefty. And I just remember him kind of taking me under his wing. You know, I was so green coming to college. I didn't drink. I didn't do anything. And I remember, you know, Willie kind of took me under his wing. I remember we were in open gym and I was doing a dunk, and he just was like, man, he was so impressed. He was like, man, do that over again. Do it over again. He was just very encouraging for me. He was well-liked. He was kind of a popular kid. So he was one of those guys I looked up to.
And then this picture, rest in peace. Big Smooth, Chris Williams. Just wondering if you had a story for us, because I know another name that is kind of underappreciated. They want to bring a little light to.
Yeah, man, one of the kindest human beings I've ever met. Just one of the nicest. I don't know if you can meet anybody to ever say anything bad about that guy. One of the nicest guys ever, and underappreciated. A guy that, you know, nowadays with stretch fours, he was kind of that undersized, you know, stretch four that is so popular now. Just a jewel of a guy.
Doug, do you remember anything? You're probably out of pocket for these.
No,
right?
You're making me think, man, because like guys that like us that didn't overlap or have the same coaches, you know, you guys were caught in between that weird period of like the end of Jeff Jones, the beginning of Gillen, the really good year, then the kind of demise. So I remember this team well, and I think he's from Alabama, Chris.
Yeah.
Right?
He committed to Jeff Jones, and I think he stayed with Pete Gillen, even though he wanted to leave. But
yeah, and I always remember that. Like for example, Roger, for you, I think more of you as a pro basketball player who went to the University of Virginia, right? Like I think more like of my guys as UVA guys, maybe they played in the NBA or didn't. So you guys kind of got caught in that weird spot in between, you know?
Yeah, and no, this whole
access idea, like we need to incorporate like you guys years back with my guys and do more things together.
Yeah.
Strangers, you know? I'll do my version of a fresh story for Big Smooth. So his first year coming in, he's playing at the Dell, you know, the old school Dell. I'm playing pickup, Asian kid, only Asian kid out there as usual. But I could play a little bit, you know, and I was shooting around. They said they needed one more guy, and I was playing going up against Chris. Now, I had never met him before. I was playing against him. His team proceeded to just demolish the team I was on. I didn't get the ball a single time. And then we lost. Everyone leaves. And then Chris comes over to me and says, yo, I know you can play. I can just tell. And they didn't pass you the ball once, and that's unfair. And I want you on my team, because I want them to watch you play and how it should be done. And he proceeded to pick me up, and we won a whole bunch of games. And he would kick it to me. I hit a few threes, and he would look at the guys that didn't pass to me, and it was like, that's the type of dude he was. Like, I didn't even know at the time. And then afterwards, he's like, yeah, I'm Chris Williams. I'm coming to play, da, da, da. And, like, that's the type of dude he was. Like, picking up random kid and just, like, making my life, right, in terms of, like, fandom. Like, you know, we have these little moments that you remember. And that was one for me, right, going to Dell just by myself, wanting to hoop. And, you know, the ACC, who ends up being rookie of the year, just, you know, believed in me just a couple games. But that, like, is very telling in terms of who he is as a dude. Rest in peace. That's the TW effect too.
Yeah, rest in peace, bro.
Yeah, for sure.
Lighten the mood a little bit. This is a throwback of
make sure you zoom in, Roger. This is important.
a throwback basketball. We always do this one in terms of outfits back in the day. You know, you got, you know, be nice. You got the old school guys. Ted Jeffries in the back. Another rest in peace, Sean Wilson there. But you got Dougie Fresh in the front. What are your thoughts in terms of these outfits?
Is that Brian Stith?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That was a different era. I'll say that. No, but Stith, you know, Stith had a great NBA career. He was actually, you know, a proof point to me that somebody could, you know, have a long career in the NBA out of Virginia, just like Karate did. So for me personally, I gravitate to that guy just because he's a guy that made it pro.
And then
if you look at Brian's shirt too long, though, your eyes kind of like start spinning. So be careful.
and actually, that's another question. When you came, did these guys reach out to you in any way? Did you have any connection with them? Or was it, I know the Pete Gillen era was a little bit of a black hole in terms of that, but.
Yeah, not really. I don't think Pete did a good job with incorporating the old alumni, but Norman Nolan, Corey Alexander, those guys came back. Corey had all the dopest cars. So it was like, he had the new, and he had a car shop. So like, I was always a car guy. I was mesmerized by that. Brian Stith, I might not have ever had maybe I had one conversation with him my entire life, but I never really talked to him. But Corey, I think Corey did a really good job of coming around. Like I would say he had a big impact, you know, coming back to college and playing with us and stuff like that.
And on the Virginia
team. Corey had nice cars in school too, by the way.
I heard. Yeah, that all dried up by the time I got there.
Yeah, he was super doing, it was like pimp your ride kind of thing, right? Is that that's the way I understood it. Anyway. Back the logo you have on now, you have the old one. This is the new one, kind of creating uproar here on social media. I don't know if you can call it an uproar. A lot of people are all up in arms about it. What are your thoughts on it when just glancing at it?
It looks fine. You know, it looks cool. I don't know about this orange with the – that's weird. But the V looks clean. The blue one looks fine. But I don't know what's going on with the shield. It's like, is that a – yeah, that's the only one. Maybe it'll take some getting used to. What do you guys think?
I was going to say, Mark, what are your we've never really talked about this. What are your thoughts, Mark?
We haven't, but so we've been throwing around a little bit. I haven't seen one social media post that supports it. I think there were one or two people that says, oh, it's all right. But I think for a lot of people, it's just going to take some time getting used to. There's some controversy around it, a little bit of controversy. I like the V. I do. I'm in agreement with you, Raj. I like the V, and I like the blue guy. The orange guy,
I think for me, it's like the V Saber. To me, it's not that big of a change. I know just for me, I design, you know, I'm into clothing and I design a lot of stuff. So for me, I like this a lot because it's easier to integrate into things. I'm sure that's why Nike did it, because like the other one, the V Sabers came up so high and they cross and it's hard to integrate it into design. So for me, to me, it makes sense. The guy on the right, from what I understand, it's like they're trying to make it basically fit any race, any style, any gender, where anyone could be under the Cavman as opposed to the usual. So I kind of, you know, I'm with it. I know change is always comes with hate. What about you, Dougie?
I mean, I literally, you could have told me, you could put this out for the next 10 years and I would never even notice. So I don't have any opinion whatsoever. I just know it starts with a V and you can tell Virginia, just do UVA or whatever. The one thing about the Cav man with the blue or whatever, a lot of the old school football guys don't like it because they feel like he's bowing down, like almost in defeat, right? Like you're putting your head down, not your head up to play the game. That's right. The only thing which I can get. I literally am not that deep enough of a thinker to even realize what it is. It'd be, you know, if we changed our colors to black and gold, I'd notice, right? But I wouldn't notice.
That's fair. And then a little bit of NBA photo. We talked about this earlier. This is one of your game winners. What were some, you know, Tim Duncan iconic teams that you were on? What were some of those celebrations like? Game winners.
This one was Christmas Day. My mom was battling cancer at the time, so it was like an emotional period of time for me. And actually, a week before this game, Pop drew up a play for me to hit a game winner against the Clippers. And I just remember thinking, you got Tim Duncan and Tony Parker on a team. Why the hell are you picking this for me? But you know, he did. And, you know, Tim, by far, best teammate I've ever had. Him and LeBron. But Tim was a great teammate. And as you can see by this photo, he wanted to see me do well. And it was a great experience playing with him.
Is there any particular story that of people, you know, obviously played at Wake, Virginia fans know him probably more familiar than most. But what are some sort of like Timmy stories that maybe we don't know about?
Yeah. I mean, the guy just worked. I mean, I was a gym rat and Tim was also. So I remember he was on the gun. He might've shot 400 bank shots on the gun, like before practice. And I was just thinking to myself, this guy is arguably the best power forward in history. And every morning he's with the young guys working on his game. You know, that's the type of stuff that really resonated with me, was just the work ethic behind the greatness.
Yeah, there's no secret, right, Roger? I mean, there's like probably 0.0001% of the world that doesn't have to work, even at you guys' level. But there's no secret, right? The greatest dudes are always the hard workers.
100%. 100%.
And then we're going a little bit NBA here. The short shorts. This is James Harden rolling up his shorts. We have fun with this one. What are your thoughts on the guys now rolling, going back to the short shorts? Where are you at? Because you're kind of.
Yeah, I left the NBA as a player in 2014, so I missed this era, and I'm glad I did. I don't know, man. I don't know what these young guys get. I don't know. It's over my head.
All right, this next one, another rest in peace, Kobe Bryant. This is Roger Garden Kobe. And maybe walk us through, and your boy Antoine right behind there, but talk about like his impact on you and what his death, you know, how did that go down? You know, people have told stories about like, where were you when this happened kind of moment.
Yeah, man, it's still such a sad situation. I remember when I got to the Spurs, Tim Duncan and Pop sat me down and explained to me what the Spurs-Lakers rivalry was. And as a starting shooting guard, you know, I took over for Bruce Bowen, who obviously had all those battles with Kobe. I stepped right into the fire, so to speak. So, you know, preparing to play against him, I actually hit a game winner against the Lakers, where he destroyed the locker room afterwards. And, you know, he was just a fierce, fierce competitor. And when he passed, I remember someone sent me a text message with the photo of Kobe and I on an escalator. And, you know, I've told this story before, but, you know, in 2010, we were in the middle of the lockout and I was on the executive committee, the Players Association, and we were meeting in New York to try to get the season back going. And so I'm with Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Kobe, and we're going down the escalator, and I remember KG was like talking trash to Kobe. It was like, I hit this game winner, and I just chimed in and I was like, oh yeah, that year I led the NBA in game winning shots. And KG and Paul Pierce looked at me like, no the hell you didn't. And Kobe like looked back up to him and was like, oh yes he did, he had won in Phoenix, LA, this, He named every one of my game winners.
Wow.
And I remember like being completely shocked that he knew every one. And I look back at him, and because we were doing a lockout, the media was there. So somebody got a picture of me like looking back up at Kobe. And when he passed, it was on Fox News, that picture. So wow. My friend sent me the picture, and it immediately took me back to that moment. I'm like, wow. So I have that picture of like, after Kobe said it, I'm looking at Kobe like in disbelief that he actually knew. And the following year, this guy hit 6 game winning shots and led the NBA winning shots. So that's the kind of competitor he was, man. He didn't want anybody to outdo him.
That
is awesome. If you zoom in on this picture to add some levity here, I think Antoine Jameson, is that right? He's got a look on his face like, is this motherfucker ever going to pass me the ball?
Hey,
he's like standing there by himself. He's like, oh, hey, man,
Antoine can't say that. He never passed the ball.
I was just going to say, he doesn't need the ball.
That's the Junior Burrow black hole. I get it.
And here's the next photo. Another you know, hero of mine, Allen Iverson. But this is, we got Ice Cube. This is the big three piece. Yeah, that, you know, what was that venture like for you? I know there was some rumblings of, I don't know, financial issues or whatever, but what was that experience like for you?
Man, it was a great experience. You know, it was a once in a lifetime experience to start a league. I was the first black commissioner in sports, president of the league. So, you know, creating a league from scratch is a tough thing. Ice Cube, got love for him. Obviously, his partner and I had a falling out. But you know, overall, it was a great, positive experience. I convinced AI, Rashard Lewis, Kenyon Martin. I got all the players to commit to playing. And that first year, we had a lot of fun.
And just to clear it up in terms of, like, is there still beef between you guys over this? Because I know it's, like, over, like, some business partner or something. Is that right?
So it was – the first year was a great year. You know, second year, we had some disagreements with, you know, a lot of parts of the business. And as you know, sometimes you got good partners and you got partners that it doesn't work out. But all of that was cleared up. You know, I accepted a settlement, and I wish those guys the best.
That's awesome. And then The next one. This is LeBron James.
260-pound guy falling back like that.
But then he goes on to be your teammate. So I just wanted, this is an excuse for me to hear a LeBron James story. London told one about the moment after J.R. Smith had his incident in game one of the finals. I just wanted to hear, maybe give us a nugget.
I got a lot of LeBron stories. You know, he was him and Tim Duncan are like neck and neck as the best. I'll tell you one thing. He basically, that year we were on the Heat, you got a present from LeBron damn near every week because he had so many endorsement deals. So Beats by Dre and the drinks so he was coming in the locker room giving us all kind of stuff all the time. I mean, outside of that, man, the guy is a worker, great dude, and you know, we had a veteran team, so nothing out of the norm.
So the $1 million that he spends on maintaining his health, is that a real deal?
That is a real deal. And
a big team around him that does it.
Oh, yeah. His massage guy, his stretch guy, his, you know, this one, chef, this. I mean, this guy invests, I would say, more than $1 million. I mean, from what I've seen. But he definitely dedicates his body. And there's no secret as to why he's one of the greatest.
Did you know he came to a game at JPJ last year? Did you see that?
No.
So he came, it was Duke versus, not last, 2 years ago, in the championship year. He came and sat courtside to watch, obviously, Ty Jerome. I think he was just here to, no. Zion was there, and Duke came to town, and I'm sure he wanted to also check out the best team in college basketball.
That's right.
Very cool. This next one, I wanted, this is Devin Hall walking in. I wanted to talk to you about player likeness. So he's wearing a tee that we made here, Locker Room Access. He's doing a three-finger sniff celebration. And, you know, we sort of created a platform where a lot of these guys can sort of monetize off their likeness and connect with fans similar to you coming on here. But I know you have the Vaunt, and maybe you could talk about the NBA Players Association deals and the things that you guys are building there.
We're creating sports and entertainment IP with athletes and celebrities and creating cool content around it. That's kind of what Vaunt does. And so we've got partnerships with the NBA Players Association and doing some work with the NFLPA and the MLBPA as well to just help these guys monetize their likeness and creating really fun and cool competitions with them, either on the court or even off the court.
And how can people find more about this and your involvement in terms of?
Yeah, you can go to vaunt.com, V-A-U-N-T.com. And actually right now we're doing a shooter's challenge to raise money for impacted families and small businesses and orphans affected by COVID-19. So if you go to vaunt.com, you can donate, or you can also just kind of find out more information about Vaunt.
And if we want to connect our, you know, our UVA basketball fam, I don't know, maybe you've already done that in terms of how to connect them to get stuff with this. We'll just work with you on that. Is that?
Yeah. Work with me on the plan. That. Yep.
Exactly. And then the next one is another kind of NBA Players Association throwback. We mixed it all together on this one. This is Mamadi wearing a Brian Stith jersey. And like our goal here is to, you know, connect the old with the new and sort of bring out the I don't know. I don't even know. Brotherhood is such an overused term, but just a real community in terms of like having a platform to share and appreciate the love. What are your thoughts on that in terms of like, you know, UVA at bringing it all together?
I love it. You know, I love it. I was so jealous. Most of my time in the NBA, I had no other UVA alumni in the NBA with me. So I was like carrying the flag by myself. And so, you know, I think it's great. I think that Tony and his team have done a really good job of helping connect older alumni with the current guys. And I think there's definitely opportunities to do stuff. So I love what you guys are doing with Locker Room Access.
And what about Mamadi? Where do you see him coming up? I mean, how closely have you watched him in terms of
his? I watched him very closely. So you guys may not know this. I worked in the front office of the Denver Nuggets last year. I was their pro scout. And so I scouted him pretty significantly. And I think he's a pro. I thought it was smart for him to go back to college. But I think that, you know, he's got some skill. He's obviously got the athleticism. He'll probably be, hopefully he's a second round pick and goes to the right spot. But even if he doesn't get drafted, I think he can have a long career in the NBA.
And then it's perfect timing for the next UVA alum that makes it in the league. This is a picture of Sean Singletary and his Charlotte Bobcats and you and your Spurs taking a picture together on the court. What is your relationship? I know, like the first time I met you, Summer League, I was with Sean and he introduced me to you. So I know you guys have a relationship, but maybe expand on that a little bit.
No, that's my little brother. I always, you know, when he was in college, I would come back and check on him. He would come stay with me. I gave him a key to my house for him to come and go when I was playing for the Wizards and the Spurs. So that's like my little brother. Injuries really hurt him. He should have had a long career in the NBA. He's one of the best players in UVA history and got a heart of a lion and the heart of an angel. So he's a great kid.
Yeah, I think Dougie, you met him for the first time and instantly like, oh yeah, this, I mean, yeah, my guy.
We're best friends now. Sorry, Raj.
And then one more little UVA one. U-Haul being torn down. This is a photo of the demolished U-Haul. What are your thoughts on that, you know, U-Haul going, your memories?
Yeah, I mean, U-Haul was a legendary spot. I mean, you know, it was a legendary spot. I mean, obviously, JPJ is unbelievable. But a lot of memories in U-Haul. I still remember people camping out outside. I remember the Duke wins and all that good stuff. So it's fond memories, but, you know, bigger and better with the new arena they have.
Yeah, we talk about it all the time, right? People didn't want to come in there and play at all.
No.
They didn't like coming to play at U-Haul.
And then now to the current stuff. This is a picture of UMBC game. Where were you? What were your thoughts during this?
Yeah, that was a very, very tough time for me, and it wasn't just because we lost. It's like a double whammy. It was all that ridiculousness had happened with the big three the same week, and then we lost, and everybody was texting me about Virginia losing to the highest seed in history. So it was terrible. I felt bad for the guys. I texted Tony right after the game, but that was a tough one.
And then I got, you know, that's perfect segue into Coach TB. This is him screaming at out of character, screaming after the Purdue win. But what has your contact been with him? Like when he came on board, did he give you a call?
We've had a great relationship. You know, I was, you know, in the middle of my career when he first came in, actually. And then I was the number two of the Players Association, and we were doing, you know, I was the decision maker on our coaching program. And Tony came and spoke at our coaching program. We did it, of course, the top 100 camp we do at UVA. And so my staff was at on campus for the week running the camp. And we really built a relationship off of that. So he's been a great friend, and somebody that we've stayed very close in touch.
And then here's the last one. And this is Minneapolis at post-championship photo of you right and you know behind Bronco. You got Justin, Malcolm, Ralph, Devin, Joe, Justice Bartley.
I gotta get some of your pictures, man. You got
and
some
Josh here.
I gotta get some of these pictures. No, this was a great, great moment. I mean, you know, you're part of the UVA basketball program, or you went to UVA. There's probably not a better day than the day we won this championship.
And what was your journey like to get there? Everybody's got like a little story. Like, where were you? Like, what was the decision? Like, do I come? Do I go?
I had a huge meeting with a guy named David Levy, who was the president of Turner, about him investing in my company. So I wasn't going to be able to come. And I called up Barry Parkhill, and I'm like, look, you know, I want to go to this game, but I got to get back right after the game. And of course, Barry being Barry, he's like, call this person. I'm going to connect you with this person. He's taking his plane back right after the game. So it worked out that, that, you know, one of the UVA alums, you know, has a plane and was flying back right after the game so I could make my meeting.
That is amazing. And by the way, shout out that white guy right there. I don't know who he is, but it's a great photo.
That's OG.
He's probably the guy that had the plane.
Actually, I almost got left, though. Doug and I were trying to get on the court, and they were like, uh-uh. They weren't trying to have it. Finally, I got on the court, and then I almost got left.
That story, I'm still flustered by that. I'm glad you got on.
And that segues perfectly in, Dougie, your famous question.
Yeah, so you gotta get put on the spot with us a little bit, Roger. There's no wrong answer. It's your criteria. It can be whoever you thought was the nicest guy, the best player, whatever. You're Virginia basketball Mount Rushmore through the years. And you get five. Mount Rushmore, I learned, has four heads, but we give you five of them.
Mount Rushmore, so the five all-time greats?
Positionless, however you want. However you want to do it.
Basketball players. One from UVA basketball.
So you got to start with Ralph. You got to start with Ralph Sampson. Then you got to go to, Barry Parkhill.
Smart man.
Shout out the plane trip. Yeah, you got the trip.
Yeah, anybody gets you like
that. Shout out the plane trip, 100%. And then here's where it gets a little bit shaky.
The problem is if you're like 6 seconds in between people, my head immediately goes up.
Okay.
So I'm on there. 1993.
Right. So
take your time.
I'm gonna definitely put Sean Singletary on there, pound for pound. I got it for what he did for the program. I get him up there in the top five. We got a championship, so I gotta say, is it? I can't, man. Dre played out of his mind. Malcolm Brogdon was amazing. Also, this is tough. He didn't win the championship. Ugh. Who led the team in scoring in that championship team? Can you give me some information?
Scoring, I don't know. Well, scoring the whole season?
Yeah, the season and then in the NCAA tournament.
I think was it Kyle that led the team in scoring?
I think it was.
I think Kyle and Dre was close second.
Dre, they were back and forth between Dre and Kyle.
I don't think. I mean, you don't win a championship without Kyle. You don't win without Ty. You don't win without Dre. So,
right.
I don't know. But I think you'll probably have to put Dre in that spot. If you've got anybody in that spot, you probably got to put Dre. And then the fifth one, I don't know. Maybe Malcolm Brogdon, you know, with his – what did he win? Defensive player of the year and ACC player of the year?
First player ever, yep.
Yeah, so I think you got to put him on. That's probably my top five at UVA.
I love it.
Good list. A lot of those guys are on a lot of people's too. I thought you were going to go with the guy with a nice shirt on in the old school 1990 picture.
Be stiff. Well, he didn't know Be Stiff, right?
No, and I mean, yes, Be Stiff was a hell of a player, but didn't win a championship, you know.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I think it's interesting to see people's five. There's so many great ones.
Yeah, it's no wrong
answer. And what their formula is for picking,
right?
As well, right? Because one of yours criteria is possibly you got to throw a guy that won a championship.
Yeah, 100%.
And everybody says Ralph. Ralph is the staple. Ralph's on everybody's list.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I actually talked to Ralph this week.
He's a good dude. We're trying to talk to him too. He's going to get on here at some point. But anyway.
So just want to follow up, Roger, with what you've done in your career after basketball.
Yeah. Right?
You've had a lot of success.
Been very fortunate. I attribute it to mentors, but I quit playing early. After 11 years, I had an opportunity of a lifetime to transition as an executive with the NBA Players Association to be the first deputy executive director there. So that was great. For 2.5 years, went back to school, went to Columbia Business School for a year. And then we did our last CBA with the NBA. And I decided to become an entrepreneur and start the league. So I started the Big Three League as one of the owners, and then also started Vaunt at the same time. And so we've been working on Vaunt ever since. And then doing other stuff on the side, you know, continuing to just build my portfolio.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, look forward to working with you here with Locker Room Access. We'll see.
Did you have to finish your Virginia degree, or did you have it in degree?
Yeah, I finished my degree. Yeah, I finished my degree while I played in the league.
Wow.
So I always said I'm going to get my degree, so I did that. And then
– how long did it take you?
It took me about 3 years. Yeah, it took me – I chipped away at it. I didn't get my degree from UBA. I would have been impossible because I would have had to come back. I was in the School of Architecture, Urban Planning. But I ended up getting my degree. And then my second year out of the NBA, when I was at the Players Association, I studied for the GMAT for a few weeks, actually. And I applied to two schools, MIT and Columbia. I got into both, and I ended up going to Columbia.
That's awesome. Congrats.
Yeah, I turned MIT down, then I decided to go to Virginia instead when I got in there. he just threw that out there. I applied to MIT and Columbia. I got into both of them. Okay. What can he not do?
You're the man. We so appreciate you jumping on here, man.
I love what you guys are doing. This is I'd love to be a part of it. Anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely be talking to you offline for sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, you've been telling me about this for a while, Mark, but this is dope.
Yeah, no, it is. And I know you got some stuff still going on at the NBPA.
Yeah, I'm just super, super tight with those guys. Nothing officially. I have a partnership with Group Licensing Rights, but Michelle Roberts is my girl. And, you know, those are my people over there.
So I got to meet Michelle Rob. So I was helping Baron Davis with some stuff with Twitch, and he sort of like roped me in as part of his crew. And I met Michelle and obviously a bunch of people at the NBA and stuff, and Ralph was there too. So yeah, we'll all have to sync up and figure out some ways to work together.
Yeah, for sure.
We will figure that out. In the meantime, listeners, please don't forget to subscribe and like this podcast. Follow us and subscribe to us on Apple and Spotify. Big thanks to Roger Mason Jr. For T-Dubs and Cali, for Dougie Fresh Smith across the Hudson. I'm Mark Jerome, and we're giving you Locker Room Access.